Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. The Caldor Fire burning in El Dorado County crossed Highway 50 this weekend. The wildfire burning near Kybers, which is roughly 20 miles east of Pollock Pines, prompted closures of a portion of the highway. Highway 50 is closed in both directions from Sly Park Road to Twin Bridges. However, is open between Myers and Twin Bridges for local residents. As of this morning, more than 100,000 acres have burned. That's about 150 square miles. The wildfire is 5% contained since igniting just over a week ago. Joining us with an update on the Caldor Fire is Captain Keith Wade with Sacramento City Fire Department. Captain Wade is assisting Cal Fire. Welcome back to Insight, Captain Wade.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, this was a concern, and there were intermittent closures of Highway 50. How significant was the wildfire crossing over to Highway 50 this past weekend?
So it was definitely a concern for the firefighters assigned to the incident, and luckily we had planned ahead of time. We had plenty of firefighters north of 50, mostly in the form of a hand crew and dozers that were positioned up there to be able to cut off any sort of a spot fire that occurred. They held that to about 200 acres. They're still working to contain with some increased containment lines up in that area, but it's not further spreading, and they believe that it's not going to gain a foothold and become a separate fire. So that's the good news, and that was the only spot fire north of 50.
Well, that's promising to hear. Can you describe the area where that spot fire took place?
Very rugged terrain. It's very steep slopes. When those cast embers that we've been experiencing that shoot out above the head of the fire, sometimes half mile to a mile, when it hit the slope, ran up the slope. That's where it was met by our firefighters, hand crews, and dozers that were up there, and they worked hard way overnight to contain that incident. They're doing very good work over there along all perimeters of the fire now, as we're starting to see some of the containment lines start to increase. I think this percentage is going to creep up as the days go on and the firefighters continue to strengthen and harden these containment lines.
Is there an update to traffic? Any idea when that portion of Highway 50 will be reopened?
Yeah, we don't know yet because that fire is still very active on the south side of 50 as it's been spreading east, and we've been watching it come down the ridge. I was actually physically near Eagle Ridge yesterday and watching it as it was spotting out ahead. And those firefighters have been making sure that they're protecting those structures, increasing defensible space, and really prepping them for any sort of fire that might come their way. So it's still not safe for citizens to come, and we appreciate their patience.
You know, I'm seeing reports that hundreds of homes have been destroyed. What is the number that you have right now?
So right now for most of the properties that we have for destroyed, we're just over 400. Several commercial structures, and there's other like outbuildings, smaller sheds and stuff. That's sitting at just under 150. We haven't seen a major increase over the last several days with losing any sort of structures. And a lot of that has to do with favorable weather conditions. There's been low winds now. The inversion layer has been hanging with us in the morning, keeping that fire, making it to lay down. And then the topography has been the biggest challenge, though, especially down the south end of the fire, still near where it originated. We're dealing with some canyon fires. As these fires get in these canyons and drainages, we get erratic winds and can push them into hard-to-reach areas and can make it very difficult for firefighters. So it's a challenge down there in the south.
Well, I mean, even going off of that, when reading the daily updates, there are other hazards out there. I mean, there's fire damaged timber, ember cast. Can you just explain the other hazards that firefighters are facing?
I'm glad you bring that up, because I was talking to some firefighters yesterday, and they were explaining to me that the biggest issue on this fire, because of the topography, is the rollout. And that's these dead fuels out there, mostly big timber that's been smoldering, took a lot of fire impact. They're hot, and once they drop down, they'll roll down the hills because of gravity, and then their hot ember casts coming off of them are easily igniting other vegetation as they roll down the mountainside, and they can pass containment lines that have been established at points. So that has been a big issue for the firefighters who are working to try to contain this.
You were talking that conditions have become more favorable in the past few days. Is that allowed for a significant degree of support from aircraft?
Absolutely. I was listening to the numbers this morning at the operational briefing to the firefighters who are moving out to the line today, and they were talking in the number of hundreds of thousands. So I heard 300 plus thousand gallons of water being dropped yesterday, almost 300,000 gallons worth of retardant being dropped. I mean, these are significant amounts of air assets dropping, suppression from the air to the ground. I can tell you the firefighters love when they see all the air assets flying in the air, helping the firefight. It's been great for us, and I think we're going to start getting a foothold on this incident.
So we've gone from 0% containment last week to now 5% containment. What are the challenges in the days ahead?
Well, the challenges in the days ahead is still that east side of the fire, as it's still starting to spread in very rough, rugged terrain that we can't just put people out there safely in front of it. It's hard to access. So continuing to have our air assets available is paramount to our success. Continuing the planning phase as it does continues to spread, making sure that we're allocating our resources strategically, having them in the right place. And really, it's the containment lines. And to get successful containment lines takes man and woman power. Get out there into the smoldering areas, ensure that we darken it down, take all the heat out of that about 200 to 300 feet inside of the actual fire line. That way we can say this is a containment line that's going to hold, and then it gets marked up as a percentage. And that's why it's taken some time, because we have been short personnel on this incident.
Yeah, I mean, when we talk about mutual aid, it's not only within the state, but it's also from outside of the state. So in addition to these extreme fire conditions, are strained firefighter resources throughout the country. So how is that challenging mutual aid from outside of the state?
Well, I just yesterday saw some firefighters from Idaho coming in here. And what I've been learning about our federal brothers and sisters, they are taxed and tired as they've been moving from state to state, going to all different kinds of fires. And they're rolling in here as we speak. We're gaining more and more personnel, but it's been a challenge because there are so many fires burning in the West. And I'm glad I'm not the one having to make the decisions on who is going where and deciding what areas deserve the most resources at this time, because all these fires are important to put out. And this one, threatening so many communities, has definitely needed a lot of resources thrown at it. And luckily, we've been getting them. We're over 1,700 personnel on this right now.
Finally, 9 national forests are closed through Labor Day. So that includes Lake Tahoe and El Dorado National Forests, where the Caldor Fire is burning, but also Plumas, Lassen, and Shasta Trinity, which is where the Dixie Fire is burning. What's the status of the Dixie Fire?
So I haven't gotten a personal update here, as I'm, assigned to the Caldor down here, but that Dixie Fire has been burning a long time. It's taken a lot of personnel up in that area to try to deal with that incident, and we truly do appreciate everyone's patience as these fires continue to burn throughout our state. We don't want to have anyone out of their properties or their homes any time longer than necessary, and believe me, everyone is working hard to try to get everyone back to some sense of normal and get us through this fire season safely.
Thank you so much, Captain Wade.
Yeah, you are welcome. Have a great day.
Captain Keith Wade is with Sacramento City Fire Department. He is assisting with CAL FIRE in the Caldor Fire, which is burning in El Dorado County and is 5% contained. Up next, Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn joins us about his upcoming retirement and the road ahead. We'll also learn how UC Davis is ensuring Afghanistan refugees and those displaced are able to secure essential documents. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. Sacramento Police Chief Daniel Hahn will be retiring at the end of the year. Chief Hahn's roots are local. The Sacramento native was raised in Oak Park, joined the Sacramento Police Department for more than 20 years before becoming the city's first Black police chief. His 4 years as police chief encompassed a volatile and painful time when the country took a critical eye at law enforcement, highlighting long systemic issues. Protests filled the streets, calling for racial justice and an end to the killing of unarmed people who were disproportionately Black and brown young men. Chief Hahn has been praised for making changes with within the department, including new transparency measures, improved community relations, and new training for officers. But the work and passionate calls for change are far from over. Joining us now to reflect on his time with Sacramento Police and the road ahead is Police Chief Daniel Hahn. Welcome back to Insight.
Morning, Vicki. How are you?
Doing good, thank you. Well, if I remember correctly, it's been a while, given COVID, when I visited your office in the past for interviews, I was always struck by a photo that you have of yourself as a teenager hanging on your wall. I mean, it became one of the more formative experiences and really shaped the trajectory of your life. Can you explain the meaning behind that photo?
I'm not sure which photo you're talking about. I have a lot of photos on my wall.
I'm seeing some of your family right now behind you.
Yeah. I mean, every one of us, our experiences really play the largest role in who we are. And so my family, my mom, my daughters, my wife really shape what I believe. So I think it's important that they're constant reminders to me by my computer, on my walls, et cetera, why I do this.
And there was a photo of you as a juvenile, correct? As a teenager?
There's some on my desk, yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I guess when it comes to, you know, your childhood and your history, like all of us, I mean, how did that prepare you for just the uncomfortable, difficult, and painful discussions that we have as a community?
Yeah, I think probably the two things that prepare me the most for what I've done for 34 years and 10 years as chief is, one, my mom. She's a very strong, engaged person in the Oak Park community, and was always very selfless and always tried to do the right thing. And then two, the neighborhood I grew up in, the relationships and the people that mentored me and guided me through Oak Park are the two things that I think guide me the most in this work.
Your retirement announcement came to a surprise to many people. I mean, what discussions, internal or otherwise, led to this decision?
Well, probably the biggest discussions were my wife and I of the right time. And I know we talk about 4 years as police chief here, but I was chief 6.5 years prior to that in Roseville. And I think last I heard, the average of a lifespan of a chief is 3.5 years. And so it's not an easy job. It's a challenging job, especially in times as you described at the beginning of this interview. And after 34 years of being a police officer, my family and I thought it was time to do something different.
You know, given that you were a police chief in nearby Placer County in Roseville and now police chief here in Sacramento, how was the job different in Roseville compared to Sacramento, especially given that you're a Sacramento native and you've been with the department for more than 2 decades?
Yeah, I think in many ways it's the same. Being in charge of a agency where not only is the community depending on your agency, but the members of your agency are depending on you, is challenging. And we had some very challenging times in Roseville when I was there too. But I think a large city is different than smaller cities. We have a lot more challenges or different challenges. Obviously Sacramento is a lot more diverse, not only in race and gender, but with beliefs and experiences than Roseville was. So they both have their unique challenges, but I have to say, when I was in Roseville, there were some large profile incidents that happened in Sacramento. And I can remember sitting in my office in Roseville, wishing I was here. And I know that seems kind of weird, like why you'd want to be somewhere in challenging times. But I've always felt this is my city, is where I grew up and lived my whole life. And if we're going to go through challenging times, I want to be part of the solution to that. And I don't believe anybody cares more about this city than I do. And so I've been extremely grateful and thankful to have been here for the last 4 years while we go through those incidents and times that you spoke about earlier. I'm very thankful I came home, and I'm very happy to have been here during that.
I'm curious, even with your background in law enforcement locally, if the demand of the job surprised you. I mean, in your first year as police chief, there was the police shooting of Stephon Clark. Protests filled Sacramento. I remember even shutting down Interstate 5, and it really didn't stop in the years after that. It became very clear that there's deep-rooted pain, anger, and frustration that I think came to the surface in a way I don't know if your recent predecessors experienced.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it rose to the level of of surprise. I've always felt like this can happen anywhere, in a small city, in a large city, because we have these underlying issues in our country, not just in Sacramento, but in our country, that we don't seem to ever really address. And so all it takes is an incident, and an incident can happen anywhere. And so I wouldn't say I was surprised. It was obviously challenging. These aren't unprecedented times. Some of them are unprecedented for Sacramento, but they're not unprecedented for our country. There's cities been burning before. There's much worse protests that have happened in our country before for hundreds of years, but we don't seem to really address it in a holistic fashion. And so we are have been doomed to repeat it. So I've spent my time, at least in part, trying to address those underlying issues in our department and in our community.
With hindsight, what would you have done differently in your 4 years as police chief?
Well, I wouldn't say there's anything I can point to off the top of my head I would do differently, other than maybe some communication issues, both internally and externally. And those are probably countless, that better communication could have been had, might have avoided some things. But I also think those mistakes are what got us to where we're at now, and to the transparency and the ability to communicate both internally and externally. And hopefully that will serve us for years to come, and we'll continue to get better at it. But to your question right before that, of the challenging times, nothing surprised me, but you know, it does take its toll. When you have officers guarding your house 24 hours a day for way too many days, when you have death threats that include your family, where, you know, last year as schools got shut down, so my wife is at work, I'm at work, but our daughters are at home by themselves while there's active death threats and threats to protest our house. Those take your toll, and both mentally and physically, and you worry about the well-being of your family. And, you know, to me, that just takes it too far. You know, we've seen protests at the city manager's house. We've seen protests at the mayor's house. And to me, I just wholeheartedly think that goes too far. That's not, we're not going to get people to sign up for these jobs that are qualified if those are the kind of activities that their families have to suffer.
Yeah, and diversity within your department, as well as departments across the country, remain largely white. I mean, you also welcomed research and reports of your department that ultimately quantified inequities and disparities that exist in police responses. What progress have you made in the 4 years? Because there's still work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I don't do efforts to increase diversity in the police department so a picture looks more diverse. I do it because largely diversity brings different experiences that we need to serve a very diverse city and a very diverse community. And the reality is we can't keep doing the same thing and expect different results when it comes to diversity of our staff. And so we've done just that. We've changed the way we recruit. We've changed how we recruit. We just aren't getting the applicants that we used to. And those applicants, for police officer anyway, were never diverse in the first place. And so we've went to council over the last couple of years and expanded the number of CSOs and student trainees and interns in our department. And those ranks are part-time, entry-level, largely filled by college students that work around their college schedules. And those are extremely diverse, both gender and racially. And, you know, it takes time, and those folks eventually transition into the regular police academy or full-time dispatchers and things like that. And so we are on a good path for increased diversity through those new positions. You just can't keep doing the same old thing and expect something different to happen.
Are there moments that stick with you where you felt your hands were tied and you wish you could have done more?
Oh, yeah, there's always things where I think we went down a wrong path, but you know, anytime that there's politics and other issues involved, you have to do the best you can with what you have. And there's always those moments and those incidents where you wish you were able to do something else, but you had to do the best you can. So those will always be around. That's our form of government. I think in the long run, it still makes us make the best decisions. Our form of government allows us to, you know, have to compromise and not have, you know, decisions that will wholly mistreat groups of people. But we have a long ways to go. We have underlying things in this country that have been around for a very long time that still impact the well-being of certain segments of our society to this day.
What advice do you have for the upcoming police chief?
Well, you know, change is not bad. Change is good. And, you know, hopefully, and I'm sure there will, the next police chief will still believe in increasing trust and increasing partnerships, but they might have different ideas of how to get there. And that's good. That's fine. That's what, why, you know, chiefs change. It's good to have a different voice and different ideas in a major part of the well-being of our community. But the one thing I would say is in this environment, and probably will always be like this, anytime you're a leader of an organization our size that's so important to our community, you just have to, at every step, do what you believe is right. No matter what, do what you believe is right, because there will never be probably more than 50% of the people that agree with you. And so if you bounce back and forth with trying to please this group or that group, as opposed to just whatever it is you think is right at the time, and sometimes you're going to be wrong in hindsight. But so that's what I do. I learned that from my mom. At every point, I do what I think is right, no matter how painful that might be.
Given the fact that you're talking about challenges of recruitment within the department, what advice do you have for those who want to join law enforcement and become officers?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I'm a person that never even thought about being a police officer growing up. As a matter of fact, for about the first 7 or 8 years of my career, my plan was to quit and go be a teacher and start my own business. My degree, I don't have any degrees in criminal justice. My degree from Sac State is in business administration. And yet now here I sit, 34 years of doing this work, and I can 100% without a doubt say this is the best job I could have ever had. As challenging as it is at times, I've worked basically 20 plus different careers in one, as a teacher, as a patrol officer, as a media person, and the list goes on and on. This is a job that you can help somebody every single day in this community if your heart is in the right place. And so one of the reasons I think why I never thought about being a police officer is, one, I never knew any officers. Nobody in my community knew any officers. We weren't friends with any officers. And quite frankly, police officers didn't have a high, we didn't have high regard for police officers in my community in Oak Park. But I also only thought officers drove around in black and white squad cars and arrested people and cited people. And once I got into the department after several years, I found out there's a lot of other things that officers do. And I think if people knew that, all the different things you could do as a police officer, there would be more interest. And so we spend a lot of time bringing the community into the police department and our officers into the community to do just that.
Finally, I'm sure you've started thinking about the future. I mean, any idea what your next steps are going to be?
I actually have no idea. I get asked, am I running for sheriff? Am I running for mayor? Am I running for office? The answer to that is no. And do I know what I must know what I'm going to do because I'm retiring? No, I do not. But I will be doing something. I'm not ready to sit at home. I do want like full-time work. But the field is really wide open. I do know this. I don't plan on being a police chief anymore. But other than that, it could be in law enforcement, out of law enforcement, associated with law enforcement. I just know that I still have a lot to give this community, and I'm not ready to sit at home. So I'll spend the next, 4.5 months trying to figure out what that's going to be to keep me out of my wife and my kids' hair.
Chief Hahn, thanks for joining us.
All right. Thank you, Vicki.
Daniel Hahn is the Sacramento Police Chief and will be retiring at the end of the year. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. Since the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan, the humanitarian crisis continues to grow as thousands have become internally displaced in their own country. According to the UN Refugee Agency, 3.5 million people were already internally displaced in Afghanistan. With the Taliban takeover, that number has increased immensely. In response, UC Davis is using an innovative project to help refugee students start or continue their university education, even as they're displaced and on the move. Article 26 Backpack offers a way for refugees to keep track of important documents online. We're talking about diplomas, transcripts, and resumes. Here to help us get a better understanding of what's going on in Afghanistan and also to tell us more about the Article 26 Backpack is Keith David Wattenpau. He is a professor and founding director of human rights studies at UC Davis and joins us now. Welcome to Insight.
Thank you, Vicki. It's good to be back on Insight.
Yes, good to have you back. Keith, what does control of Afghanistan by the Taliban mean for higher education right now?
Goodness, that's a tremendous question. Let me just start by expressing our concern on behalf of UC Davis for the tens of thousands of Afghan college students, human rights workers, journalists, and others who are really facing a terrible prospects under the Taliban. As I've written before, under the Taliban, Afghanistan's system, modern system of higher education will cease to exist. Over the last two decades, Afghanistan has invested heavily in developing a higher education sector that seeks to knit the country together as a whole by bringing in women and ethnic minorities and people who have been historically discriminated to learn and study together. And that's not what the Taliban are about. The Taliban, we know from they're just one of many stories that really caught my eye over the last couple of days, is that when a group of young women showed up for classes at Herat University, one of Afghanistan's major cities, they were greeted at the gate by the Taliban, who told them that they were not going to be allowed onto campus and that they should go home and never come back. So we're looking at the collapse of a modern system of higher education that was really what one of the critical elements or success stories, if you will, in the last 20 years in Afghanistan, that was going to help Afghanistan transition to a modern state.
How do these events currently in Afghanistan affect how and what you're teaching your students?
Well, we haven't begun teaching yet, but as your introduction noted, we've developed over the last decade, I've led a multidisciplinary research project engaging students, our undergraduates, our graduate students, refugee and human rights organizations around the world, and communities of refugees themselves, to try to better understand the impact of war and conflict on the human right to higher education. And so the outcome of that was the development of the Article 26 Backpack, which is named for the 26th article of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which says that all of us, no matter what, have the right to an education, a right to achieve higher education where we can. And it's just part of being human is also being able to learn and to teach. And so one of the things that we began to understand is that amongst refugee populations, there's this tremendous anxiety about the ability to hold on to documents. Right? But what we also learned, and much of this work was built around the civil war in Syria, which has displaced, again, many millions of people, including millions of young people, is that not only if you don't have your documents, are you able to continue, right? If you don't have them, institutions and others will say, well, you know, where's your high school diploma? Where's your transcripts? Where are your letters of recommendation? We can't let you in. But that often hostile regimes will deny access to documents, necessary documents for refugees, as a way to punish or to discipline them. And our real concern in Afghanistan, and this was our concern about a year and a half ago when we first began to develop a way to bring Afghans into this ability for us to help them curate, store, and share safely their critical documentation, is that the Taliban have been going into people's homes and searching for their documents to see if they had been working with the United States or they've been critical of the Taliban. And we know from people like Aisha Wahab, the mayor pro tem of Hayward, that the backpack is a way for Afghans, primarily educated Afghans, that generation of Afghans that emerged over the last 20 years, to safely store those materials that they will need to rebuild their lives in exile, while at the same time protecting themselves from attacks from the Taliban. So, this is a tool that engages our students. And I have to just, over the last 5 or 6 days, we've mounted this really intense effort to bring as many Afghans into the backpack as we possibly could. But our students have been staying up well into the early hours of the morning, because that's the day in Afghanistan, working with Afghans, helping them understand what we're doing and bringing them on board. So this has been a remarkable learning tool for our students at UC Davis and our broader UC Davis community about the impact of the collapse of the corrupt Afghan government in the face of the Taliban. That extends what we do in the classroom into the real world.
Help us visualize the Article 26 backpack, because it's a cloud-based folder system.
Right. So what backpack does, and it's really, we like to think of it as a human digital ecosystem, because what it does is it builds connection between people who are often excluded from access to higher education opportunities to include them under the auspices of UC Davis. And so what people do is they register for it, and a digital platform appears in one of five languages. We were able to develop Backpack first in English and Arabic, but over the last couple of years, we've added Dari, which is the language of Afghanistan, Spanish, which we're beginning to use now to reach out, not just into Central and South America, but also to help support our own DACA and Dreamer students as they face continuing anxiety and uncertainty about their status. And also French, which, you know, we're using now at UC Davis to reach out to people affected by the earthquake and the upheaval in Haiti, but also at the core of a project that we're going to be doing in Rwanda over the next year to assist refugees from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Burundi. And so they come onto the backpack and they can fill in information about their education in a way that's consistent with the best practices outlined by the American Association of Collegiate Registrars and Admissions Officers, probably the most important people in our lives you've never really heard of. And then also they can take photographs of their important documents and upload them immediately into the backpack platform. And so this is how Afghans are using this tool right now. So they've got a document, they can put it on a table, they can use their cell phone to take a picture of it, and then safely secure it on the cloud. And then if necessary, destroy that document so that there's not the physical copy there in Afghanistan that might be used against them by the Taliban. And then once all these materials are uploaded in the backpack, and it's diplomas, it's letters of recommendation, creative works, video statements of purpose, these young people are able to share those documents safely and securely through a UC Davis administered share feature around the world. So we first used it in Lebanon in 2018, 2019 to help displaced Syrian refugee students. And what I remember thinking when we were working in Lebanon on this project, and CAP Radio was there with us, in fact, when we interviewed us from Lebanon, the project, I thought, you know, wouldn't it have been better if we had had this kind of tool available to us before the problems happen? And that was the case. And thankfully, we had that for Afghanistan. And we'd thought we had about another 6 months to more fully build it out in the country. But the events were so quick. The collapse was so precipitous. And the sense of emergency so great that we couldn't. And so we've been engaged in a really sort of concerted social media-based effort and collaboration with global higher education organizations and refugee organizations to get the word out.
And when we think about a cloud-based system, you know, we can think about, you know, iCloud or Google. How is the backpack different from those cloud-based systems?
Well, the most important thing is that we don't mine or sell people's data. Right? So when people trust us to conserve and protect their documents at UC Davis, and this is so important for refugees, right? These are amongst the world's most vulnerable people. These are the people for whom human rights truly matter because they have such little access to them. So we do not use this as a tool to exploit people, but rather as a tool to support people. And you know, we do not collaborate with any of the sort of major data mining or other services that are out there. We host this ourselves and we protect it with the same level of protection that we provide to our own students.
You know, I was looking back at a UC Davis July podcast that you were part of and just reading that the global refugee population has more than doubled over the past decade to 26 million people. You're also talking about this backpack already being available to Syrian refugees, expanding it to Haiti and Rwanda. And obviously, we're talking about Afghanistan. In that time, what success stories or what meaningful stories stick with you?
Well, the most important stories that stick with me are when we work with refugees, and we built this in collaboration with refugee communities. And that's really an important feature of how we approach our thinking about human rights in the UC Davis Human Rights Studies program, which is that human rights studies is a way for the university to connect effectively with communities here in California, in the United States, in the Western Hemisphere, and around the world, around trying to support and defend the human rights of others and really empowering our own students to be part of that process. But what's really stuck with me, aside from the fact that so many young people around the world are willing to engage with us and trust us to take care of these tool, these critical elements of their digital identity, is that they often say, you know, we thought we'd been forgotten. We thought the world had forgotten us. And that's true. In many ways, the world has forgotten the world's refugees population. I mean, there are more refugees now than in any other time in human history, yet this is not on the front page of every newspaper. And the COVID emergency has I think, increased the problems facing refugees around the world. They're already on the edge, and this has pushed many into more deeper forms of poverty and displacement. And what Backpack is committed to, and what we're really committed to at UC Davis as we address this Afghan emergency, is telling refugees, you are not forgotten. You're human beings like we are. We will do what we can to provide you with opportunity and bring you in to our communities as friends, as neighbors, and eventually as fellow citizens. So that's one of the critical elements of my experience with Backpack. Yes, it's good for us to use it to help with applications and so on, but it's our statement of the fact that we believe in these young people and how they have a right to a future just like the rest of us.
Keith, thank you for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you.
Keith David Wattenpah is a professor and founding director of human rights studies at UC Davis. He's talking to us about the Article 26 backpack that is a cloud-based system allowing refugees to secure very important documents to continue higher education. Still ahead, we can learn more about the little-known family life of infamous mobster Al Capone ahead of a forthcoming auction of his estate. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. Al Capone is widely considered one of the most notorious American gangsters of the Prohibition era. Turns out, the only child of the infamous mobster, known as Scarface, was living in relative obscurity, about a half-hour drive outside Sacramento in the city of Auburn. Al Capone's son, Sonny Capone, was living with his daughters in the foothills. And those daughters are now sharing personal stories about their grandfather ahead of an upcoming auction of Al Capone's estate in Sacramento. The auction will take place on October 8th at Witherell's Auction House. Brian Witherell is an auction antique dealer and runs Witherell's Auction House. Brian joins us now. Welcome to Inside.
Good morning.
And we're also joined by Diane Patricia Capone, the granddaughter of Al Capone. Diane, welcome to Inside.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Diane, when did you and your sisters come to the decision to share a personal side of your grandfather and unveil family treasures?
It's a decision it's taken quite a long time because we really didn't want to let go of some of these things. But we began to realize we were getting older, and if we were ever going to take charge and make sure it was done properly, we better do it before one of us wasn't here any longer. Also, all the fires in Northern California over the last few years have really been worrisome. We didn't want to take a chance on any of these things being lost.
I'm just curious, what brought you to Auburn?
Family. We lived in the Bay Area from the time we came to California in the early 60s, initially in Palo Alto. And my sister moved up here in the 90s, early 90s. And one by one, the rest of the family, including ultimately my dad, all moved here.
Growing up, was it openly discussed with others that you were Al Capone's granddaughter?
Well, I went to school. I grew up in Florida. I was born in Miami Beach, Florida, right near my grandparents' home on Palm Island. And I grew up in Miami, always attended school as Diane Capone. And so our family name was well known in Florida when we were growing up. And so, yes, everybody knew it there.
And what about in Auburn? I mean, that's, you know, a pretty small community in the foothills. I think the population is like 6,000.
It is a small community. We moved up here literally when we retired. My husband retired from Lockheed in 97. And so we moved up here. And for the most part, the people in Auburn who know that my maiden name was Capone are people who were friends of ours. But more and more, since my book came out, are going to know that I live in the area.
You know, your father was Al Capone's only child. What stories did he share with you?
Both my father and my grandmother, over many, many years, just always told stories about how wonderfully kind and generous my grandfather was, and also reminded us how much he adored us. He was a very devoted, loving father and a very devoted, loving grandfather. And my dad didn't want to take a chance that we would forget who he was, and especially because so much of the public information about him is so different than what our personal experiences were.
Yeah, I guess going off of that, I mean, given that Al Capone is one of the most notorious American gangsters in U.S. history, but obviously represents something very different to you as being his granddaughter, how do you reconcile the two, you know, his infamy with his family life?
You know, that is something we've often called it a conundrum. How in the world a man who had the public reputation and was alleged to have done some of the things he did could possibly be this incredibly loving man? And I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. Clearly, he was a very complex person who had a multifaceted personality. But the personality that we saw at home and that his family and friends saw was a very, very different man than what some of the public saw. He was devoted to family from the time he was a child and spent most of his life trying to make sure that his family was well cared for.
All right, Brian, you're heading the international auction in Sacramento, and I'm just curious, how did you land this? I mean, I think of like Christie's in New York or something that would come to top of mind.
Well, I suppose it was good luck in its basic sense, but we were fortunate enough to get the call from the Capone heirs, and I think we made a compelling case on how the material should be handled, and they trusted us with that, and we're very grateful for it. Our primary objective is to make sure that we at Witherell's take care of our consigners, number one, and number two, take care of the buyers. That's the reason we've taken such measures to ensure the integrity and the genuineness of these items that we're offering by making sure that each item is accompanied with an item that can't be faked.
If you take us back to the moment when this was introduced to you, what did you think when the name Capone came up?
There's a lot of things that run through your head. I mean, is the Capone family, you know, still in business? Was one, and what are we walking into? Which was quickly diminished once we met the Capone heirs. We were not naive to the fact that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity and that this is a celebrity-type auction that I think you could argue may go down in history as one of the most important celebrity auctions in history. So we're honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, I was going through the catalog, and many of us know about Al Capone, his public life, his time in prison at Alcatraz. What more are we learning about him now through this auction?
This is very distinct from other celebrity auctions in that it's really a time capsule. Of how he lived with his family. You get a chance when you go through this auction to look basically through the family's photo album. You see the last photo of Al Capone taken, which sort of changes the opinion that's been thrown out there about his health. He looks very healthy, holding his grandchildren. You see the personality and the kindness of this man when you read his letter to his son from Alcatraz, expressing his love. And it's unmistakable. So, you know, it's interesting from Diane's perspective how she's presenting this as his granddaughter. But from our perspective, when you look at the material culture that we're offering in this time capsule of an auction, it supports that.
You had just talked about the prison letter to his son, and I would imagine that's going to be, you know, one of the auction highlights. What are others that really stand out to you? I mean, the catalog is considerable. There are a lot of items.
Yes, I think that's one of the top lots. I think the other items that will generate a lot of interest will be his personal jewelry items. So, you know, not only do we have all of these items have unbroken family provenance to substantiate their authenticity, but when you see these bejeweled items of a very flamboyant gangster, such as his pocket knife, his Patek Philippe pocket watch, I think those will generate a lot of interest. Of course, the letter. Then there's household goods, but that on their own would not be very valuable. But when you put them in context and you realize Al Capone drank out of this glass, Al Capone slept in this bed, he took his tobacco from this humidor. And when you put that into context, I think it makes them far more compelling than they would be otherwise.
Diane, in the last minute that we have, which of these items has the most meaning to you personally?
I think the thing that I particularly love is the photograph of my grandfather and my father. My father went through very serious ear surgery when he was about 6 or 7 years old and almost died, and his head had to be shaved. And there's a photograph of Papa and Daddy, and my dad has a hat pulled down almost to his eyes, his eyebrows, covering up the fact that his hair had been shaved. And the back of that photograph has a wonderful autograph from my grandfather to my dear son, Sonny, from your dear dad. That's something that is very precious to me.
Diane, thank you for spending time with us this morning.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
And Brian, thanks for giving us a run through of the catalog.
Of course.
Brian Witherell is an antique dealer and runs Witherell's Auction House in Sacramento. Diane Patricia Capone is the granddaughter of Al Capone. Capone's estate will be auctioned here in Sacramento on October 8th. That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.